make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners. One minute you're up $500,000 in soybeans and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
The revolution starts now. Starts
now. We have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
Turn those machines back on!
You are about to enter the Peter Schiff Show.
Show me the money!
If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth.
The Peter Schiff Show is on. Call in now. 855-4-SCHIFF. That's 855-472-4433.
I don't know when they decided that they wanted to make a virtue out of selfishness.
Your money. Your stories.
Your freedom.
The Peter Schiff Show.
Hello, this is Jeffrey Tucker with Laissez-Faire Books and the Laissez-Faire Club, and I'm very pleased to be substituting today for Peter Schiff, who is out and about. I was very happy to have spent about a week with Peter, actually, in Sao Paulo, Brazil. We were at a conference for Mises Brazil, speaking together, got a chance to spend a lot of time together on buses, at dinner, late-night hangouts, all sorts of things, and he's a great teacher, a great intellectual, a brilliant thinker, one of the most articulate economists, I would say, in the country. In fact, I think I wrote a tribute to him about 6 weeks ago, but that's not why he's having me substitute, I hope. In any case, we've got a lot of news going on today here in this country. All over the headlines, of course, is the devastating defeat of the labor unions in Wisconsin and the victory of Scott Walker. Remember that name. He will be strongly considered and for notoriety within the GOP, and there's going to be a lot of push to see him ascend up the party ranks and become a big player. He stood up to the unions, cut the budget, broke the union power, and started to balance the budget, something that's absolutely necessary, not only Wisconsin, but in every other state, and in the whole country, from the federal government all the way down. So he did what nobody else seems to be wanting to do, and faced a recall election and soundly defeated the opponents. So the results didn't surprise me, actually, at all, despite even late last night, all the pundits were saying that it's a close election. Oh, we'll have no idea who's going to win. Well, you know, guess what? The public sector unions constitute a tiny percentage of the electorate. We know which way they're going to vote. They had to bamboozle a larger percentage of the Wisconsin voters to go along with them, basically go along with the idea that the taxpayers are going to continue to be looted to support this sort of what strikes me as a vaguely criminal band of lobbyists here. And they didn't succeed. And the reason they didn't succeed is that their case was just downright implausible. There has to be some cuts in the public sector if we're going to be balancing the budgets. Now, let me address something that's very interesting here that people don't often think about this. Now, Wisconsin has to have a balanced budget, as does every other state in this country. They can't just run debts forever and ever. They all face the possibility of going belly up unless they have a balanced budget. So every once in a while, a political leader like Scott Walker comes along and says, "Okay, let's make the hard decisions that have to be made and get this state back on a sound financial footing." Now, you might ask yourself, why doesn't this happen at the federal level? I mean, how come essentially for the last 100 years we've had presidents elected with the promise that they're going to balance the budget through spending cuts and then not actually achieve those spending cuts, and yet somehow everything continues to run? There are a few exceptions along the way. There were some government cuts after World War II. There were some cuts in some areas under Reagan, but they were completely dwarfed by the vast spending increases. So the question is, why doesn't reality ever sort of come home in any kind of way to the federal government? And the answer comes back to the same subject that this show talks about all the time, namely the Federal Reserve and the central banking and the central bank itself, which has the ability to just create money out of thin air. If you've got a printing press to cover all of your debts, then what's that going to do to your spending habits? They're just going to continue on just as profitably as they ever were before. They talk about spending cuts, but there's really no need, in a way, financially, for spending cuts. You've got a Federal Reserve over there willing to fund any kind of debts and cover up and paper over all the problems now and forever and create trillions and trillions of dollars and call the system too big to fail. Then reality never really hits these people in the face like it does at the state level. At the state level, there is no Federal Reserve. There's no central bank that allows people to just create endless money. So, of course, they have to balance the budgets. In other words, the states face the same kind of fiscal situation, all 50 of them, that the federal government faced when we were on a gold standard, when there wasn't any ability for a central bank to print unlimited quantities of money. And we were on a gold standard until 1971, a gold standard of sorts. But going back to the 19th century, look at the late 19th century and the Gilded Age, we had fiscal discipline because the government didn't have the ability to create unlimited quantities of money, this magic, seemingly magic power to just invent a reality of its own. So this is what's gotten us in such trouble as a nation. And it's also the same thing that's killing the European economy day by day by day. They keep bailing out and avoiding the hard decisions. And the reason they're able to avoid those hard decisions is because they've got these horrible institutions called central banks. Central banks are the thing that have created Leviathan. They sustain the Leviathan state. People talk about spending cuts, but in the end, they just are too convenient, too politically advantageous to rely on Ben Bernanke to come to the rescue or whoever is heading the central bank. That's why the states and the European unions don't cut the budgets, and that's why it's not being cut at the national level, and why I don't believe it's ever really going to be cut. What it's going to come down to in the end is some sort of continued mismanagement of the whole system, all thanks to the Federal Reserve, which provides this kind of moral hazard. The Federal Reserve brings out the worst in the political class, makes them even worse than they would otherwise be. But let me say a few words about Scott Walker in particular. This is an unusual situation. It illustrates the difficulties we're going to face in the future with cutting the state. Now, the politics of the state reveals something. With politics of the state, that reveals something that's very unusual. We have a governor coming in that's trying to cut the government. That's very weird to public sector unions. You know, that's sort of like a new CEO of a company that's trying to drive down the stock price or something. I mean, these people don't understand this. I mean, the job of a governor, from their point of view, isn't to cut the government. The job of the governor is to expand the government, protect their rights and privileges, and do all the things that the public sector and the bureaucrats and the vast apparatus that we call the state wants it to do. That's what they see the job of the governor. So this guy is very unusual. He's doing something that's extremely rare. And I would say it's a kind of a intrinsic problem that in our system. We have this unity between the executive administrators and the bureaucrats to loot the rest of us. Let's think about that going forward, and we'll be back in a minute.
The Peter Schiff Show. If knowledge is power, then the Peter Schiff Show is a uranium-enriched 10,000 megawatt nuclear reactor. Stay plugged in. Stay brilliant. This is the Peter Schiff Show.
Hey, this is Jeffrey Tucker with Laissez-Faire Books and the Laissez-Faire Club, and I'm sitting in for my good friend Peter Schiff, and it's a real pleasure to be here. You know, I run a daily email newsletter called Laissez-Faire Today, lfb.org. You can go over there to the website and just go to the sidebar there, put your email address in, and I'll be sending you a big article every single day. It was a few weeks ago I wrote a big tribute to Peter Schiff himself and explained why he's great and why what he has to say really matters. But every day I address some other new topic, and yesterday I wrote a little bit about Hayek, and today I'm going to be writing a little bit about the zombie apocalypse. So if you go over there right now and sign up, you'll find out everything I think about the zombie apocalypse and how it relates to our collapsing physical world economy. Now, let's return to this Wisconsin thing just really quickly here, because I think it illustrates just something that's incredibly stupid about the American system. You know, this election cost me like $18 million. What a vast waste of money. You know, they tried to recall the governor, and then they have this big election. They, you know, spend all the taxpayer money. People have to drop, you know, leave their offices, forget whatever they're thinking about, their homes, their families, their work, and all that, and start focusing on these idiotic political concerns, all because of a gang of thieves called public sector unions. We're all trying to loot everybody again. It's a terrible system. But, you know, the problems are actually, in fact, much greater than what people think. There's a myth in this country that somehow if we just elect the right guy, that's going to change everything. You know, as you remember this when Obama, you know, was elected, there's these loopy-headed, crazy people all over the country imagining that somehow Valhalla was going to arrive. It was like this, the Messiah on the white horses come to bring us some sort of utopian, you know, vision of the world, and that his magic touch was going to transform everything. And now, oh, they're so disappointed that Obama didn't accomplish this great end. Well, this whole thing is preposterous. Let me explain something to you about the way things really work in government. Okay, we have a thing called the nation state, and little mini nation states in all the 50 states around the country. The people you're electing, the people you're voting for to get into office, are mostly just figureheads. They have a little bit of power to do this or that and change some policies, maybe make new policies. They certainly have the ability to expand the government in ways that they find beneficial to all of their friends. But the first job of any guy who takes office is to, first of all, reward all the people who supported him in his election. And he rewards them with jobs and with favors. And so all the people who supported them immediately become part of the problem instead of being part of the solution. And then most of his days spent doing stupid things like greeting dignitaries, signing, you know, little sweet notes to people, and whatever time's left over, he's mostly padding his bank accounts and for his reelection campaign. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. The real government has very little to do with anybody you and I elect. It has to do with the millions and millions of people who are on the public payroll, who constitute the permanent bureaucracy of the state. They administer the laws that Congress passes, not just passed in the last month or in the last week or in the last couple of years, but has ever passed. So the bureaucracies are still pushing out laws that were made 100 years ago and everything between right now and all the way back then. So that's the apparatus of the state. That's the true public sector. When we talk about the government, that's 98% of the government. People you and I will never meet, have nothing to do with electing, and cannot and are not controlled by the executives who happen to swing in and swing out of office, you know, every few years when this charade called elections goes on. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. You know what happens in the big bureaucracies when we get a new president or a new governor or whatever? The new executive appoints somebody to head the bureaucracy. He's a political appointee. The permanent bureaucracy pays virtually no attention to whoever happens to be there. All it means is that the pictures on the wall in the hallways of the grand bureaucracies are changed. The old guy comes down, and the new guy goes up, and the employees walk by and go, oh, who's that new clown? You know, and they forget about him. And they laugh about it and go about their business because it doesn't matter to them in the slightest. What I'm saying is that mostly it's a charade. And, okay, fine. That's been the kind of system of government we've had that's dominated the world probably for the last 300 or 400 years, this permanent nation state. Fine. You can be for that, you can be against it, but let's be honest about it. You know, this notion that somehow that elections are going to fundamentally change anything is utter nonsense. It doesn't do anything but change the sort of the ideological package under which the state is currently sailing at the moment. And it may or may not mean any change in the reality at all. You know, when a CEO becomes a head of a company, you know, there you have a profit incentive. You have a unified goal to maximize the value of the company. And people will tend to get behind the CEO. But even then, it's a very difficult job to manage any kind of company, especially when you've got stockholders breathing down your neck. But at least you've got a unified vision. In government, it's completely different. First of all, the size of the institution is vastly larger than any company. And you've got an army of bureaucrats who are against you. If you're trying to get them to change, getting them to certainly cut the budget, I mean, that's like a catastrophe, right? So any good guy who gets elected is going to face a gigantic army of people who hate his guts and are going to do anything possible to resist everything he wants to do. That's the reality that you're dealing with here in government. So I don't mean to spread despair here. I'm just trying to draw attention to reality. There is no white knight on a horse that's going to come and save us, who's going to slash the budget, abolish the Fed, withdraw the troops from abroad, or anything. Nothing like that. That's not going to happen. How are we going to get change? Well, change will happen in ways, I think, that are unexpected, just as it happened in the old Soviet Union. Nobody expected that one day they'd wake up and the whole apparatus would just begin to crumble down to the ground. And then it spread all over Eastern Europe and all over the world. In fact, change happens in every country slightly differently and always in ways that we don't expect, and always in response to an ideological change on the part of the American people. So what I'm saying is the more people who understand what freedom is and how government growth is incompatible with freedom, the greater our chances are for making fundamental change in this country. And it's probably not going to happen by just electing the right people in office. So I think Scott Walker probably did a very good thing in Wisconsin. I'm all for standing up to these thieves, to the thieves and the looters. But I don't have much hope that somehow he's going to come along and do that at the federal level. First of all, because we got a Federal Reserve that's willing to finance the expansion of government power until the end of time. And secondly, because I really have doubts about anybody with power. And I don't think that giving one person a whole lot of power is going to be the answer to our problems. Our real answers are going to come from the very bottom root of things. And it could come in response to what Peter often talks about, which is a grave financial crisis, which we probably face today. It's probably around the corner. It could come next week. It could come in 5 years. But the current system as it exists, where you just spend all you want forever and ever and throw troops in, you know, in every country in the world and enter every single war and try to run this world empire like this, it's not going to work. The system is corrupt, and it's not working. It's driving the economy into the ground, and at some point, people are going to start connecting the dots and going, hey, you know, when our economy is freer, we had more growth, more prosperity. Now that the bureaucrats are running everything, the Federal Reserve is managing everything, and we've got all these terrible policies going on, we're losing out. We're getting poorer. There are fewer opportunities. My children don't even want to live in this country anymore. They're looking for places to move to. So a lot of people are beginning to notice. And when this reality dawns, I think that's where we're going to begin to see fundamental change in this country. And probably not till that time. We'll be back in a moment.
The Peter Schiff Show.
We now return to the Peter Schiff Show.
Call in now, 855-4-SCHIFF.
That's 855-472-4433.
Rebel Radio, the Peter Schiff Show.
Hey, this is Jeffrey Tucker of Laissez-Faire Books, Laissez-Faire Club. I'm substituting today for Peter Schiff. Like I said before, if you want to get my daily newsletter, you can go to lfb.org. Sign up for Laissez-Faire today. I've got an article coming out later today on the zombie apocalypse. You'll be interested to know how that relates to our current financial struggles. But listen, I'm so excited today to have on my show somebody who I think is just a real expert in so many areas, it's uncountable. I mean, I was really happy to have him. I thought I would have him talk about one of the issues that's vexing us today, namely unemployment. Everybody's in a panic because unemployment just went up. And nobody really knows what to do about it or where it comes from. I can tell you this man knows something about the subject. His name is Sheldon Richman, and he is the illustrious editor of the very famous journal, The Freeman, which has something like a 50-year history. You can see the journal at thefreemanonline.org. Sheldon, welcome, and thanks for being our guest today on The Peter Schiff Show.
Good morning, Jeff. Thank you very much for asking me. It's a great honor.
Well, let me just raise the topic of unemployment. You've been following the catastrophe ever since, I guess, 2008, right? And you've seen the numbers, you know, high, growing, not shrinking, the labor pool continuing to fall. If you were going to name, just say, three problems, three causes, what would they be?
Wow. The Federal Reserve what Bob Higgs calls regime uncertainty. In other words, nobody knows what rules and taxes are coming down the pike in the next week, month, year, 5 years. Well, those are two pretty big ones. Can I think of a third one?
Well, we can go back to the first one.
Yeah.
You know, because it's very interesting to me, because part of the mandate of the Federal Reserve is to keep unemployment very low. I mean, that's what they believe their job is. And you're saying that, yeah. No, it's actually the opposite.
That's one of the big jokes.
Uh-huh.
That somehow the Fed can stabilize the economy by what? Creating money as if it was some sort of all-seeing Wizard of Oz who knew how much money there ought to be. And, of course, we know that there are just mere mortals behind that curtain, and we ignore them to our peril. No, when the Fed creates an inflationary boom, it along with other federal government policies like all the housing interventions, draws resources but also people into areas they wouldn't have gone had the Fed not been doing that, had the Fed not existed, had interest rates not been artificially depressed. So,
a good example might be housing, right? I mean, they drew them to
right.
the housing.
Housing and finance. So mm-hmm. It's been pointed out that the Austrian theory of malinvestment is very well known, right? Money goes into, say, building long-term capital assets or durables like housing, but it also distorts the labor market. People are drawn into kinds of work that they wouldn't go into otherwise. So you had a big flow of people into construction and also to Wall Street. That's all artificial. Those people are now not well trained for the jobs that really would really reflect what consumers want. So it's
okay.
A malinvestment in labor as well, in human capital.
But so that explains
that's what we're seeing. That's why we have a lot of job openings that can't be filled, and yet we have high unemployment.
Yeah, this is what's interesting here. Now, you've explained a boom, you know, how it is that people are working in a bunch of boom time industries that are unsustainable. But when the bust happens, okay, so they get fired, they get the people get laid off, and things aren't as rosy as they were before. But why doesn't the economy adjust? I mean, that's really the question. I mean, people are sitting at home, their good workers got a lot of talent, they're ready to work, and yet they can't find jobs. So where's the adjustment process, and what's gone wrong?
Well, the adjustment process would go on, although it takes time. As Austrians, we understand things always take time. And there'd be cost involved, because if you have an investment in one part of the country that's inappropriate, like machines or a factory that doesn't really reflect consumer demand, it's not costless to convert that into other kinds of equipment in another part of the country. So there is a process, but the government gets in the way of the process. The government won't let the process work. It's trying to keep housing prices up, for example. It keeps pumping money into the economy. It manipulates the tax laws or creates other kinds of interventions to encourage activity. But it doesn't know what activity ought to be encouraged. It won't let the process play out. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're talking about an ideal kind of market style situation, but you know we don't really have a free market, right? I mean, you've got gigantic payroll taxes that are involved, and I mean when a company tries to hire a worker, there's huge costs beyond just negotiating, you know, mutually beneficial terms.
No, that's right. And don't forget, they've done things since 2009, which has only made things worse. For example, they passed Obamacare, but Obamacare was not just a specific law that said from now on, you know, we're going to do X, Y, Z. What Obamacare did was tell Health and Human Services to write up, you know, hundreds of new rules, and those haven't been written yet. Those things will govern employer-based health insurance, but those rules are not all written yet. They're going to take time to write. So people are frozen in place. We don't know. Why would you hire before you know what the rules are that are going to be imposed on you? Same thing with Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank is a 2,300-page law regarding the revamping of the regulation of the financial industry. And yet it's the same thing. It doesn't contain the rules. It simply licenses executive agencies to write the rules. So again, nobody knows what the rules are going to be. So why would you undertake a long-term risky investment when you don't know what the government's rules are going to be?
Yeah.
Because a new rule coming down next week or next month or next year could make a mockery out of your plans.
Now, how much what do you think about the minimum wage? I mean, hasn't in real terms minimum wage gone up, you know, higher in the last 5 years than it has been? You know, it's the single biggest increase we've seen in something like 50 years. I mean, to what extent is that just actually keeping people from even being able to market themselves on the labor
Well, that's
market?
Right. That's hurting young people. High school kids are having very difficult time getting jobs. You have high school people who have graduated high school who have a hard time getting jobs. Those are the very people who are on the lowest rung. They don't have the skills yet. They don't have the worldly knowledge about the world of work. So obviously they're not very productive. And if the minimum wage is effective, in other words, if it really is above what the market would set, those people won't get work. And that will scar them for life. Because it's those early jobs, and you know about this. You've written about this a lot.
Yeah.
You've written profoundly about this. It's that first job and the second job where you learn so much, not the particular skill, but those more general skills about showing up on time, being conscientious, doing a good job, knowing people. All that's so important, and we're telling those people, to hell with you. Go, you know, go play checkers or something.
And these days, people are graduating from college. They're expecting to get the high-paying jobs, you know, but those jobs aren't really available, or they're not being they're not accessible to people. So they're looking for any kind of job, you know. And so I'm thinking here that maybe the minimum wage is actually affecting even things like college graduates. You know, if they're looking for just something, so they can pay back their student loans, so they're willing to work 60 hours a week. You know, and yet they have no real skills, really, to speak of. And they're going out into the market. They're facing an employer pool that's actually resisting to even hiring at that lowest possible level.
That's right. And they have, and what's worse than in years past, they have tons of debt. And there's a bubble that's going to blow up, too. Tons of debt. I understand that the total student debt is greater than credit card debt in the country. And then you have a lot of students who are giving up on college after going a little bit, and so they have debt and not even a degree. So once again, the government has led people down this primrose path, which is highly deceptive, and it's really a snare. And they're going to be in trouble, but then a lot of other people and banks are going to be in trouble because the loans won't be paid. What's the government going to do then? Of course, it's going to step in and bail out because we have this moral hazard problem, where the banks know that despite the protestations, despite the promises that we're not going to bail out banks, they know darn well they're going to get bailed out.
I got a train coming by here. It'll be by just a second here. It's so funny. I've got a train mural behind me, and it makes it more realistic.
That's the train of history, locomotive of history.
But, you know, I think I read the other day that for the first time ever on record that the majority of people who are unemployed today actually have some college education. That's never happened before. So, in other words, I think that we've got a kind of cultural predisposition to think of the unemployed people as, well, those people, maybe they're a little lazy, maybe they're a little bit stupid, you know, hanging around, living off unemployment benefits or whatever. It seems like the character of the pool of unemployed is really changing. It looks a lot more like maybe what you and I were like, you know, some years ago, or what our children may be like, you know, in a few years.
No, I think that's right, and it seems to be widely acknowledged that the last couple of recession recoveries, as anemic as they are largely jobless recoveries. Even when there is some recovered activity, the jobs don't come along the way they used to before the 90s. So something has structurally changed, and I just think it's years and years of intervention has misshaped the economy. It's really changed the economy. So we're so much further from a free market than we were even, say, 20 years ago, that you get this, like I say, you can barely call it a recovery, but by historical standards even, there's not even job creation.
Well, I'm hoping that when we come back here, Sheldon, we can talk a little bit more about healthcare and its relationship to job creation. Hang on just a moment. We'll be back.
The Peter Schiff Show.
You've heard of Karl Marx, right? Well, now, meet his worst nightmare. This is The Peter Schiff Show.
This is Jeffrey Tucker, substituting for Peter Schiff today. Very pleased to be here. I'm the editor of Laissez-Faire Books, and I run the Laissez-Faire Club. You can get my daily newsletter at lfb.org. I'm sending out an article later today on the zombie apocalypse. I'm sure you want to know how that's related to the current financial mess, and I discuss that in today's issue. And up to the top of the hour, we're going to continue to have with us Sheldon Richman, who's the editor of The Freeman, which you can see at thefreemanonline.org. It's a journal that's been published for 50 years. Sheldon, in many ways, is the successor to one of my great heroes, Frank Chodorov. And Sheldon is, in some ways, the Frank Chodorov of our time. Welcome back, Sheldon.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You can't pay me a higher compliment, in my view. I love Frank Chodorov.
Yeah, I love Frank Chodorov. He's fun to read, right? Liberating,
yes.
Gives you that sense of freedom to think whatever you want to think and
absolutely.
Tell the truth, right? Yeah, and that's what The Freeman's all about, right? It's about telling the truth and thinking about freedom.
That's absolutely right.
So before the break, we were talking about the unemployment problem, and I just have this persistent sense that healthcare is very much related to this. It's extremely expensive to provide employees healthcare when they get hired, and there's certain conditions under which you have no choice but to provide it, and that's going to get worse in the years to come. So my question to you is, you know, where did this idea come from in the first place that somehow business should be providing healthcare? I mean, how do these get entangled, and why should they be entangled at all?
Right. You're right. If you step back a second, it looks totally stupid. We don't get our auto insurance or life insurance generally from our employer. It's actually a quirk of World War II. You won't be surprised to learn that another bad thing came from war. War seems to be the, as Mises said, he said peace is the father of all good things, so war must be the father of all bad things, or certainly most of them. During the war, there were wage and price controls. So if companies wanted to hire somebody away from another company, they couldn't offer a higher salary because of the controls. So someone came up with a bright idea. Well, what if we give a non-cash form of payment, namely health insurance? And they asked the government, and the government eventually said, sure, we won't count that. So you'll notice when you get health insurance from your employer, that is not considered income. In other words, you don't declare it on your income tax return. And I'm not in favor of income tax returns, so I don't want anything declared on income tax returns. But if you look at the dynamic of the way the system is set up, It's a non-taxed form of income. It's certainly worth something. People are glad that when they go to the doctor that some portion of it is paid for, not out of their own pocket. But of course, if you're getting this health benefit, you're getting less cash. Because if an employer is going to hire you and pay you, he's looking at the total cost to him of having you on the payroll, and part of that cost is buying your health insurance. So you regard it as a form of income, although it doesn't get taxed, and he regards it as a form of your income that he's got to pay, even though the money may go to a company rather than to you, and he doesn't get taxed for it because it's a cost of hiring. So you have this non-cash form of income that would have been in cash in a free market where you just got your insurance outside, or you bought whatever insurance you wanted apart from your employer. But there's a tax benefit. Like I said, if you get cash, you get taxed on it. If you get it as health insurance, you don't get taxed on it. So the government has pushed us into employer-based insurance, and Obamacare only reinforces that. It didn't try to move us away from it at all. It liked the idea. Yeah. Employers, I think, generally like the idea because it gives them more bargaining power over labor.
Yeah,
because a lot of people are afraid to leave their job because they're not sure they're going to have the coverage. Let's say they have an existing condition. They're not sure they're going to get the coverage when they go to their next place, or maybe it doesn't kick in right away or something like that. So there's what they call job lock. People will stay in jobs entirely because of the insurance.
And that's in a way that hits the very core of freedom. I mean, the freedom to change jobs, job mobility, that's part of the essence of free enterprise. You know, I mean, it's something that's part of a human right. I mean, if a system doesn't permit that, doesn't create the conditions that allow you to choose where you want to work, there's something fundamentally wrong. And I think you're right. This job lock problem is terrible. Once people get that health care, they get on the system, they just kind of go, oh, phew, I'm saved, you know.
Right.
And this is especially true for people with families. You know, they start to get terrified about the idea of providing their own health. And they don't even explore the possibility that you could actually maybe go out in the markets and buy your own health care. And we'll see how long that even lasts, right?
Because if you buy it on your own, that cash gets taxed. If you get it from your employer, it does not get taxed. That's a very big, you know, that's a very, very big government thumb on the scale, on the side of the employer providing it. Look, in an earlier time, working class people, I don't mean wealthy people, working class people got health insurance through mutual aid societies, through what they called friendly societies or lodges or fraternal organizations. That meant they weren't tied to an employer because they got their insurance independent of their job and their workplace. That's a form of freedom that we, you know, hardly anybody alive today can even think of.
And, you know, it seems to me when you're looking at these health care reform proposals, I'm always looking for any proposal that steps even just a small step away from this system of tying healthcare to business, because it seems like to your job, because otherwise it's not a real reform. I mean, until you can get it untied from this crazy system we have, there's not going to be a price associated with healthcare, so it's not going to be properly allocated, right?
But Obama has tied the knot tighter.
Yeah.
Because, and what about the Obamacare requires employers to provide it.
Yeah.
And you know, the government will step in if help is needed, right? It's ready to subsidize, but still, it does not in any way remove the barriers to you going out and buying your own. There's still going to be this tax advantage to getting it from your employer. So,
to my knowledge,
it's another snare and another delusion.
And it doesn't seem like there's any serious Republican proposal that's going to deal with the heart of this issue either. But can I go back to that case where you were talking about World War II? Because there's a step missing. You said that it was a kind of a workaround that large corporations use to be able to compensate their employees without getting around wage controls. And that I get, but it became a mandate at some point in history. And I'm doing a conjectural history because I hadn't read about this, but I'm guessing that what happened was that the large corporations, once they had the system built in place, decided that, you know, if you can universalize it and make a coercive mandate, then that gives them a sort of a large advantage over their competition. Have you looked into any of that history?
Well, I don't think it's become a mandate until Obamacare. It has not previously been a mandate. Now, there's a But you don't need it to, you really, you don't need it to be a mandate if you have such a big tax advantage, right?
Yeah.
Look, if you're the, look at the, from the point of view of the employee, I could say to my employer, look, give me, instead of giving me insurance, give me, I don't know, whatever it is, $3,000, and I'm going to buy my own. Except he can't, if he gives me $3,000, that's going to be reduced by the IRS and by my state income tax. So I'm not going to get $3,000, am I?
Yeah.
But so if he can, gives me three, if he spends $3,000 on a policy, then I get the $3,000, I get the $3,000 policy. So yeah. You really don't need a mandate. That's almost a mandate. That's a de facto mandate. But yeah, Obamacare did it anyway. Obamacare puts in a mandate.
Sheldon, we got to finish the segment up. Thank you so much for being my guest today. You're a brilliant teacher and a great expositor of freedom. And thank you for being with us again. He's the editor of The Freeman, which you can subscribe to at thefreemanonline.org. Thank you, Sheldon.
Make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners. One minute you're up half a million in soybeans and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
The revolution starts now.
Starts.
We have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
Turn those machines back on!
You are about to enter the Peter Schiff Show.
Show me the money!
If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth.
The Peter Schiff Show is on.
Call in now. 855-4-SCHIFF.
That's 855-472-4433.
I don't know when they decided that they wanted to make a virtue out of selfishness.
Your money. Your stories.
Your freedom.
The Peter Schiff Show.
This is Jeffrey Tucker, editor of Laissez-Faire Books and head of the Laissez-Faire Club. I run a daily newsletter called Laissez-Faire Today. You can subscribe by going to the sidebar of lfb.org. I send out an article every day that covers economics and politics and a little bit of philosophy, too. Today I'm writing about the zombie apocalypse, and you'll be curious to know how that relates to our current crisis in the world economy today. You know, at the root of so much of our problems, it comes down to this. Politicians are spending money that they have yet to steal from us, and that therefore requires a vast run-up in debt, and then the system has to try to deal with that debt, and then they call the central bankers to bail them out, and this just goes on in successive rounds of horrible things. Here to discuss this with me today is Addison Wiggin. Let me tell you about him. He's executive publisher of Agora Financial. It's an independent economic forecasting financial firm. He's also the president of Laissez-Faire Books. I just finished his newest book, which is really, I think, set to take off in sales. It could be a real blockbuster. And he's going to be telling us about that new book. And, you know, reading it, I really had a profound sense of one that I hadn't had since I read Garrett years ago, about just what enslavement is associated with indebtedness, whether it's on the individual level or institutional level, corporate level, or international level. And of course, we've got a world now swarming in debt. That's the very core of his new book, The Little Book of the Shrinking Dollar. Welcome, Addison Wiggin.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey. How are you doing?
Well, everything's going great. So we're talking about depressing topics. Maybe you'll be able to give us some answers here. First of all, you think I'm right about the problem of politicians stealing money that they or spending money they haven't yet stolen?
Yeah, I don't think you have to look any further than the latest CBO projections, which just came out yesterday, on what the national debt is going to do in the next 10 years. They're projecting right now, if nothing changes, they're projecting the national debt, which has already been increasing by $1 trillion a year, will double in size. Will be up to $32 trillion. Now that figure is just mind-boggling. Nobody understands even what a trillion is, but the rate at which it's growing is actually picking up speed. When we premiered a movie that we made called IOUSA in 2008, the national debt had not yet crested $10 trillion. And it took 2.5 years to make the film, and we thought we were being gloom and doomers by forecasting that by the time the next president, we didn't know it was going to be Obama at the time, took office, it would be $10 trillion. We premiered it in August of 2008, and the national debt actually crossed $10 trillion by the end of September. So our projections using the CBO numbers were way off. So the fact that the CBO is now forecasting that the debt will double in the next 10 years is probably light. We're looking at debt just ballooning out of control, right, and a political situation that you know, politicians are just out to lunch. They're not even addressing the issue.
Yeah, I mean, these numbers are essentially inconceivable, right? Whether it's $3 trillion or $32 trillion or $320 trillion, you can just add the zeros as you want. The human mind is not capable of even understanding this, and yet it is a reality, right? Isn't the whole point of debt that it gets paid off at some point?
It either gets paid off or it gets liquidated. Often what happens in history, I'm glad you brought up Garrett, another inspiration for the work that we do at Agora Financial is John T. Flynn, and he, back in the 30s, wrote a book called As We Go Marching and showed what happened in Italy in the 20s when they had a ballooning debt crisis. Generally what happens, and the U.S. is pretty good at doing this too, Italy invaded Ethiopia, which was then the poorest country in the nation, in an effort to ramp up their war machine and liquidate debts that they knew they wouldn't be able to pay back. We're seeing smaller versions of that, you know, over the last decade from the United States. But the biggest danger would be if the debt doesn't balloon the way they expect it to, the way even the government bureaucrats expect it to, you're going to see advanced militarization in society. And as Warren Buffett says it in IOUSA, demagogues are going to come along and do some very foolish things.
Yeah, very dangerous situation. Now, the conventional wisdom is that one of the reasons we got into the problems we did in the 1930s is that we didn't have an activist central bank. We had a central bank, but it wasn't ready to intervene at the drop of a hat. Now we have that. Therefore, we're protected from the downsides of these kinds of policies.
Well, I wouldn't say we're protected because over the long term, the dollar does go down and the standard of living for average Americans erodes over the long term. We had this big debate when we were putting together the book with Wiley. It's part of their little book series, and we drew on a lot of the resources we have from Agora Financial, including guys like Dr. Ron Paul and Jim Rogers and Mark Faber, people who are notable about commenting on the dollar. They wanted to call it the little book of the fluctuating dollar because it, in fact, like right now, it's at a 22-month high against the euro, and they kept saying, well, it goes up and it goes down. Well, it goes up and it goes down in relationship to other fiat currencies, but over the long term, they all go down. It's kind of a, you know, it's a decade or decades-long race to the bottom, and unfortunately, it's entrepreneurs, business owners, the middle class who suffer the most because they don't have the protections built in to the legal system, and they can't legislate their way out of problems. They just have to deal with the money they're dealt with. And the more the central bank prints, the more the government spends and doesn't account for their spending or even come up with the money they need, the more average Americans who are trying to maintain their standard of living, the more they get hurt. And that's exactly what the book addresses directly, explains the causes. But then also we spent a fair amount of time, most of the book, coming up with solutions that average individuals can use. In fact, there are 47 different plays described in the book that you can use with your money to protect yourself against.
Yeah, that's the trick to survive in times like this, and that's
yeah,
where I
absolutely
found your book most interesting. Thank you so much, Addison. We'll be right back with some more talk about the shrinking dollar.
Forget about stupidity. Discover your ability. Develop your creativity.
The Peter Schiff Show.
Humility to brave. The stormy weather.
oh, my brother, and heed my foolish words. You see, the more you...
9 out of 10 historians agree. If Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine were alive today, both would be Schiff Radio premium members.
Somewhere up there, Thomas Jefferson is looking down with great pride.
Schiff Radio continues right now.
This is Jeffrey Tucker back again, substituting here for Peter Schiff. You know, in today's issue of Laissez-Faire Today, it was actually yesterday's issue, I wrote a little bit about what Peter Schiff and I discussed when we were hanging out in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and how we both had a kind of Hayekian moment looking out over the city and realizing that it's just preposterous, this idea that you would put a government in charge of such a complex system as this. So I'd talk a little bit about my discussions with Peter over those wonderful few days that I spent there. And we're back again here with Addison Wiggin, the author of the little book of the declining dollar. You know, Addison, in the last segment, you mentioned something about how the Financial News will report something like, well, the dollar rose against the euro. And people hear that and they think, rose? The dollar rose? How could that be right? I mean, it seems like my dollar buys less all the time. I don't even think that most financial reporters entirely understand what you're talking about there, the difference between the dollar falling relative to other currencies and it's the dollar's actual purchasing power. Why don't you explain that again, lay it out a little bit more.
Generally what people are talking about when they report that number is the dollar index, and the dollar is measured against six other currencies like the euro, the Swiss franc, the pound. And relative to that, it can rise and fall. So currency traders can buy or sell, and the value of the dollar is deemed to go up and down. But that, in so much of financial media today, is just noise. It really doesn't mean anything. What we're concerned about over the long term is the purchasing power of the dollar and what it can buy you, what you can do, how you can save, how you can invest successfully over the long term. And, you know, we even in the 5-minute forecast, the Agora Financial Daily e-letter that I edit along with Dave Gonigam, we report that number too because it gives a measure of how the markets are reacting to specific things. For example, I mentioned that the dollar is at a 22-month high against the euro, which reflects all the anxiety that people have over the Greek and European debt crisis. They have as big or even bigger problems than what we're concerned about here in the U.S. And because, for example, the Greeks can't print their own currency, they have to enter into these austerity programs that we hear so much about. And it weighs the euro down, and by extension, the dollar looks good. But that's a short-term thing. Structurally, fundamentally, the dollar is a debt-based currency. And just to bring it back to the solutions that we provide in the Shrinking Dollar book, one of the things we worked with good friends of ours at Everbank to create a savings deposit CD that is entirely filled up with currencies that don't carry deficits, primarily not trade deficits, but they're currencies like the Swiss franc and the Singapore dollar that are fundamentally more sound than the U.S. dollar. We put that currency, that CD together about 2 years ago, and in the first year, it rose against the dollar 18%. And when you get that CD, not only are you protected in the markets if it were to go down, you get your principal back, but you also get to keep the return on the investment. So just by putting your money in that CD, it rose 18% in 1 year.
You know, I was struck when I'm reading your book just how many really implausible workarounds that you have.
It takes a lot of work these days to make your money work for you.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
The dollar
well, look,
is so
you know, we're facing a terrible problem. You know, we've got the zero interest rate policy, which is just crazy. So if normally financial system rewards savers, right?
Right.
But now we've got a kind of totally screwy system where the Federal Reserve said, no, the saver shouldn't be rewarded. That saving's a terrible thing. We're not going to pay you anything on your money. In fact, if you hold the money in the bank, you're probably going to lose money because in real terms, given the inflation rate. And then, you know, in the past, people say, well, the answer is to put your money into your home, right? Now, that myth has just been exploded, blown up. I mean, Addison, I think a lot of regular people are really quite panicked. They don't know what to do.
I mean, that was why we wrote the book, because we focused on coming up with workarounds, as you call them, ways that people can use their money wisely and combat this long-term, effectively, it's a debt crisis that we have that's going to burn out for a long, long time.
Now, we've recently begun seeing some activity in the gold markets. Well, I guess not recently. It's been going on for a very long time. I guess that's the traditional sort of safe haven.
Certainly,
to get away
from
dollar-based assets and get over to things that are hard currencies like gold. Right?
Yeah, certainly. When we started recommending gold, it was trading at $253 an ounce. So it was at the end of a 20-year bear market. That was back in 1999. And now we're up around the $1,600 range. So those are kind of long-term trends that we're looking to identify and make sure that people are aware of the benefits of thinking differently than the normal ideas that you get from the
financial industry. Yeah, my sense is that once a person... You know, a lot of people talk about gold, and it often happens that people think about it a lot, but then don't actually act on it. And what usually happens is once a person begins to kind of buy gold, they get sort of hooked on it because they realize, oh my goodness, this isn't just a pretty little metal thing. This is a form of real financial security for me.
Yeah.
But you have to
It can be for the long term, but the danger, too, is that gold, just like everything else, trades on a market and goes up and it goes down. And a lot of people, when they start looking at gold as an asset class, they start treating it like they would stocks. They buy it when it goes up, and they buy it at the top, and then they sell it as it's going down. It makes people get into a trading mentality with gold, too. And they forget that it's really insurance for the long term against a shrinking dollar. And that's we stress that in the book. There are some recommendations on different mining companies to buy, different ways to play the bullion market, different kinds of coins to buy. But the most important part from the shrinking dollar book about understanding gold is simply that it's a long-term strategy, and you shouldn't get caught up trading it the way that that you might with penny stocks.
One of the things about the shrinking dollar, we don't want to give the impression that somehow it's just a bunch of financial advice, because it's not. It's got some really high-powered analytics throughout. I mean, you know, you explain the relationship between all these terrible things that are vexing people, you know, unemployment, huge government debt, terrible private and indebtedness, the housing crisis, the continuing recession, the high cost of education, the healthcare dilemma. I mean, all these things are interwoven throughout the book in a very kind of entertaining way.
That's what happens when you write about this stuff on a daily basis. You start seeing connections between a lot of the different things that are plaguing, primarily people trying to manage their own money. That's who we write to, and that's who we're trying to take care of. And when we draw all these connections together, you start seeing the world in a little bit different way, and you also start seeing opportunities in a way that you wouldn't ordinarily.
So you just don't despair all the time. And, you know, again and again throughout the book, you keep pointing to this core problem of the central bank. And there is a dawning public consciousness that we've got a serious problem with the Federal Reserve being really, in many ways, what Frank Chodorov might call, the root of all evil. Is it your sense that there's a growing realization that the Federal Reserve is not just some, a brilliant gang of money managers out there protecting us and keeping us safe from recessions and high unemployment, but really is the source of our problem? Would you say that reality is dawning on people?
I think more and more so. Certainly after the crisis in 2008, people started asking different questions. And then even for a long time, into 2009, 2010, there was a sense that, those guys are really smart. And as long as we let them work their magic behind the scenes, then we should be fine. But repeatedly, the can is getting kicked down the road. There's no political solution to the deficit problems and the rising debt. And the Fed has to become part of the political solution, which they keep reassuring us that they've got it all under control. And they'll know when they have to rein back and But I think that most people are vaguely aware that there's something wrong with that entire picture. And that's what we try to do in the book, is explain, you know, if you're managing the economy through ever increasing piles of debt, then we've got a serious problem, and we're going to have to deal with it at some point. Likely the Fed itself will have to come under it'll have to be dismantled or reorganized. And whenever I suggest that, people always go, oh, we can't live without a central bank. But the country has gone through this type of crisis two times before, survived, and generally what happens is the power shifts back to the people as opposed to the politicians. We have an entire political class that is dependent on the Fed accommodating their political whims. And when the crisis happens, that power will shift back to the people.
Thank you so much, Addison, for being with us. If you want a free copy of his book, it's lfb.org, free dollar book. And the book is The Little Book of the Declining Dollar. Thank you so much for being with us, Addison Wigan, Agora Financial.
We now return to the Peter Schiff Show.
Call in now, 855-4-SCHIFF.
That's 855-472-4433.
Rebel Radio, the Peter Schiff Show.
You're back with Jeffrey Tucker. I'm the head of the Laissez-Faire Club at lfb.org. I'm substituting for Peter today, who I'm pleased to say is a good friend of mine. We've had a good time hanging out here and there. I consider him something of an intellectual mentor. I write a daily newsletter called Laissez-Faire Today. You can subscribe for free at lfb.org. It's in the sidebar right there. In the last segment, we had Addison Wigan. I'm not sure if you caught the URL of his new book. It's called The Little Book of the Declining Dollar. And you can get that book for free by going to lfb.org, free dollar book. And as you can see, he's very articulate and learned on this whole subject of the catastrophe facing the American middle class thanks to the rise of debt and Federal Reserve and the growth of government. On this segment, extraordinary thing, I've got another one of my intellectual mentors on, Stefan Kinsella. He's an IP attorney, intellectual property attorney, and I tell you, this man has single-handedly shifted the way freedom lovers, liberty lovers think about the issue of intellectual property. He is the founder and director of the Center for the Study of Innovative Freedom and the founder and executive editor of Libertarian Papers, and a man I used to think had a lot of crazy ideas that I didn't believe. It took me 6 years to finally come around and finally realize that Stefan Kinsella is right. Maybe we all need little bracelets to say something like that. Stefan Kinsella is right. Stefan, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm so glad to be here.
Hey, listen, you know, I've written a ton about the issue of copyright. I consider it to be a form of censorship, a kind of monopoly privilege that the government has conferred upon some people at the expense of other people, and it seems to me the world would run just fine without it. And we can talk about copyright, but, you know, your area of expertise is, in addition to copyright, is patents. And I've always had some sense that in my own writing I've neglected this topic, partially because of, you know, I'm just not as comfortable with it as I am on the subject of copyright. Maybe you can just introduce this topic of patents. You are of the opinion that they are on net harmful to economic development and are a particularly pressing problem now in the digital world.
Yes, and they're also a threat to human liberty as well. As a practicing patent attorney who doesn't really enjoy it that much anymore, I used to think patents were worse than copyrights. I have come to the conclusion that copyrights are actually a much worse threat to liberty than patents, but patents are still pretty darn bad. I mean, the basic problem with patents is that they're just a monopoly grant by the government, which is meant to slow down competition and to protect people from competition. It originated in the Statute of Monopolies in England in 1623, at least in a modern form. And back then, they were they were honest about labeling what they were doing. They called it a statute of monopolies. And nowadays, you'll have defenders of the patent system deny that it's a monopoly grant, although everyone recognizes that it really is.
Yes, and you know, it's a kind of a problem because they're always pushed as an example of the enforcement of property rights. I've read countless books. In fact, most historians, when they talk about the history of economic development, will credit the patent for and patent enforcement for spurring economic growth, because unless you can have ownership over your innovations, then people don't have any incentive to create new things. You would say this is just a fallacy of cause and effect.
Well, it's completely ridiculous, number one. Yeah, in terms of cause and effect, there is really no empirical evidence that patents do generate some kind of net wealth in society. In fact, all the studies that have come out that that are not ambiguous indicate that patents are a net drag on innovation because they prevent people from innovating in certain areas, or they make you get permission, or there's a lot of cost to hire the patent attorneys and to pay for the lawsuits and the insurance. And so you basically have a more oligopolized industry because only a certain number of players can afford to develop these big patent arsenals.
Yeah, like Apple and right. other such. Yeah, can you give an example, maybe one that struck you recently, of how patents are inhibiting economic development, particularly in new technologies?
Well, the smartphone wars is just a raging battle right now. So you have three or four large players like Motorola, Google with their Android operating system, Apple and Microsoft, and maybe Samsung, one of the manufacturers, just filing multi-million-dollar lawsuits one after the other against each other. And the end result will either be that one of them actually gets an injunction from a court and gets to shut down their competitor's product, like an iPad competitor or an iPhone competitor or something like that, or they'll just make a royalty, they'll do a cross-license and they'll pay each other lots of money and they'll go back to business, but the little guys on the outside can't hope to compete with this. So you have this small walled garden of a small number of players who benefit from the patent laws. There have been some recent studies which are striking, just like trying to estimate the cost of what's called patent trolls.
Yeah.
Or
what is a patent troll?
What
is a patent troll? Can you tell me what a patent troll is?
Technically, a patent troll is what we call a non-practicing entity. That means someone who who has a patent, but they don't make the product that the patent covers, or they don't make any products, really. So when they sue you for patent infringement, you can't countersue them with your own patents for their competing products. So basically, you have little defense against a patent troll. And there's an estimate recently that patent trolls cost the economy like almost $500 billion over the last half a decade. If you sum up all these studies, the best estimate I've been able to come up with is that the patent system clearly imposes at least $100 billion a year of just complete deadweight cost on the economy every year, just in the U.S. alone, just from the patent system, not even from the copyright system.
And that doesn't include all the costs that are unseen, obviously, which are just just incredibly incalculable, right?
It's probably an underestimate by an order of magnitude or two.
Well, I find it, in fact, heartbreaking, because you think about all the brilliant young computer programmers that are out there today trying to get a foothold in the industry and do something new and something exciting. They face a terrible thicket, right?
Yeah.
They think they're writing fresh code. As soon as the thing takes off, next thing you know, they're slammed with all kind of lawsuits. And it's not until they become successful.
Yes.
What they're doing that they're hit. And it's my understanding too that the backlog on approving patents is as long as two years, and this is despite the patent office having something like 9,000 employees.
Oh yeah, far more than that actually, and they're allegedly profitable like the post office. Actually, I think the backlog is a good thing. The longer it takes for these monopoly grants to come out is good. But Bill Gates was famous for saying back at the dawn of the of Microsoft when it arose. Back when software was not clearly recognized as being patentable, which it is now, he has said that if software had been patentable at the inception of Microsoft, it may have never arisen. It may have killed the whole software industry.
Yeah.
But of course, now he's in favor of it.
Yeah, well, this is often what happens, right? I mean, the company develops a war chest, and then actually becomes like a convert to the cause. Steve Jobs is a good example, right? He was famously proclaimed that everything he ever did for Apple was basically stolen from other people, and he bragged about this because a good entrepreneur knows how to learn from the successes of other people. But then they get religion and decide the patents are a great thing. Now, are you saying that every company that owns any kind of patent is a sort of a bad guy?
No, of course not. In fact, that companies are compelled to acquire patents now because if you don't, you're defenseless against your competitors. But you have an incentive built into the system for everyone to waste tons of money on patent attorneys and filing fees and lawsuits just so that they can counter sue each other or threaten each other. It's like an arms race. It's almost like MAD during the Cold War. Basically, you acquire all these nuclear weapons called patents just so that you don't use them. But unlike the Cold War, you know, we don't need to have this. If we just would get rid of the patent law, no one would have to have these patents in the first place, and we would have tons of more resources available for research and development.
It sounds like we need a big Reykjavik moment, you know, like with Reagan sitting down with Gorbachev and deciding to eliminate nuclear arms. It didn't really work, but it was a nice try.
Yeah.
Maybe we need that in the patent world, too. Right, where all the big companies come together and say, "Look, this is just stupid. Let's all go to the government and say, look, we'd be better off in an atmosphere of freedom rather than this kind of, as you described, you know, IP Cold War going on, arms race."
Well, at least in the Cold War, most normal humans realize that there's a threat from nuclear weapons. Mm. There's something bad out there. The problem with patents is it's a very arcane, complicated field, and everyone's bamboozled into thinking that these government-granted monopolies, which are anti-competitive and meant to slow down competition and to protect people from competition, they've been told that they're property rights. And so they're confused about it. They let the experts handle it. Look, software patents are relatively new, about, say, 20 years old. And there's been a recent study that indicates that if the software industry in the U.S. alone was to hire enough patent attorneys to study the patents that are coming out in software to make sure they're not infringing, it would literally require 6 million full-time patent attorneys a year and about $2.7 trillion to pay them to just do this, just to avoid infringing patents. And just by comparison, the software industry only generates about $400 billion a year of profit. And there's only about 40,000 patent attorneys in the U.S. right now. So basically, we have to mobilize, you know, one-tenth of the workforce to become patent attorneys and waste, you know, about one-seventh of GDP just to make sure that companies don't emulate and compete with each other.
Stefan, when we get back, I'd like to talk to you about the relationship between intellectual property and actual property, which I understand you actually do believe in. So you're not speaking as some sort of socialist. You're talking as a real free market intellectual. We'll be returning here in just a moment.
The Peter Schiff Show.
Peter Schiff School of Advanced Economics.
Twice the education of a Harvard MBA.
For 1/168,000th the cost.
This is Jeff Tucker. That's the host sitting with Peter Schiff. You can join 25,000 others and subscribe to my daily newsletter, Laissez Faire Today. At lfb.org, it's absolutely free, and I send out something provocative and often outrageous every day. At least it'll make you think a little bit. And talk about provocative and outrageous, I think that last segment we had with Stefan Kinsella probably alarmed a lot of listeners who imagined that patents are very much like normal property rights. It's just something to be protected, and any kind of system that protects property is going to be issuing all kind of patents. But, you know, Stefan, I think you made a point that undermines this, and it was that you said that in the early days of software, there were no patents at all, and we saw gigantic amounts of creativity and growth. I mean, it implies, I think it proves that that what you call intellectual property is really not something built into the structure of the universe. It is something created by politicians.
Well, absolutely. I mean, really, until about 200 years ago, there was no institutionalized protection of intellectual property. You did have, in the height of mercantilism in Europe, in England, you had the crown granting all these monopolies basically as favors to their cronies. Someone would get the monopoly on playing cards. They didn't invent playing cards. They just basically bribed the court or gave, you know, they helped. There was monopolies on fur and sheep, and these guys would help the crown collect taxes. And then they would call the crown and the government and say, listen, I think my competitor across the street is selling some playing cards without the official seal. They're competing with me. So they would send the police in there and arrest these guys or rough the place up. So we have basically a crude version of what we have now with the government arresting Chem.com in New Zealand and confiscating CDs and DVDs and imposing taxes on blank tapes and blank media and things like that now.
It's become a real threat, hasn't it, to freedom? I mean, especially in the digital age. I mean, you've got American foreign policy all kind of geared up to enforce intellectual property all around the world.
Yeah, I mean, even John Locke and the American founders like Thomas Jefferson, even though they were mildly in favor of some kind of incentivizing system of patents, they never thought it was a property right or a natural right. They just thought, you know, maybe we can have the government grant these temporary monopolies to incentivize invention or disclosure of invention.
You make a very good point here. I mean, you know, our listeners are probably right now thinking, well, wait a minute, patents are kind of written into the Constitution. But the Constitution, the way it's phrased, represented a kind of liberalization of the patent, or at least so they believed, taking it away from something that would be owned by the government and granting it to the patent holder or the copyright holder himself. And that seemed to be a kind of individuation of intellectual property, didn't it, to that generation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that in the field of copyright, copyright was used to censor free speech and the freedom of the press and to control what was published. And so one of the reasons that the Statute of Anne in 1709 in England, which sort of institutionalized copyright, one reason it was favored by authors was because until then they had to get permission of the crown or the guilds or the church. So copyright allowed them to make the decision that their work could be published instead of being censored. And in the field of patents, the Statute of Monopolies of 1623 basically removed the power of the crown to grant arbitrary monopoly grants, but it retained one part that had been going on, which was the grant of monopolies to inventors.
Yes.
So that's why it existed, because they didn't abolish all of it in 1623.
Yeah, and then this is the problem, right? You make one little mistake, give government even the most minute power, and enough time goes by, and next thing you know, that one power is wrecking the entire system, and that seems to be what's going on right now. Now, let me ask you something very specific that people have often asked me. Let's say that I invent a piece of software, and I put it out for sale, and I come up with a way to exclude people from reverse engineering that software and marketing so-called pirated copies. Am I violating anybody's rights in doing that?
Absolutely not. There's nothing wrong with not revealing secrets or things you know unless you want to or people are willing to pay you for it. In fact, at the inception of the software sort of revolution, you would have people compile a program. They would design it in some kind of language, BASIC or C or Fortran or whatever. And then they would compile it into an executable file, and they would sell that. And it would almost impossible to reverse engineer that. You could just play it, but you didn't know how to do it yourself.
And you don't want to call that intellectual property, you want to call that just a management strategy of some sort, right?
Absolutely. It's just basically keeping some information to yourself and not revealing everything. Just like everyone has a personal life in their personal life, you don't reveal all your personal details. In your business life, you don't have to reveal all the details either to everyone.
So it's like your privacy settings on Facebook.
Exactly.
In other words, invention should just follow the normal rules of the market, which is that you can do anything you want to maximize your profitability, provided you're not seeking some kind of special favor from the state that's going to coerce a third party. So it really comes right down to it. It's not that complicated, is it?
Well, yeah. The basic insight is that there is nothing special about being an innovator. That's just another type of entrepreneur or creator on the market. And everyone in the market faces competition, and they have to come up with ways to respond to that competition. Either they offer a better service, or they bundle it with something else, or they continually innovate. But there's always competition that will arise in response to the price signals that you send out, the profit signals. When people see that you're making a profit, that's a sign to everyone in the market, hey, I'm doing something that's valuable for humanity. Why don't you come do this too?
That's
but when
right.
they do that, they reduce your profit margin, and you have to adjust. And in this
you
way,
have to innovate.
We're always
yeah.
benefited by it.
Well, Stephanie, you're the author of a book called Against Intellectual Property. The Laissez-Faire Club is publishing a special edition of your book with a new introduction and some reflections by me. The Laissez-Faire Club, as you know, works as it's like there's a cover charge, and then once you get in the door, all the drinks are for free. And I can tell you that your book is a pretty stiff drink, you know, for anybody who believes in patent copyrights. So I thank you for being on the show and for making such a difference. You know, it's a pretty rare thing in this world when somebody comes along with a brand new idea that has such a powerful effect as your idea has had. You've changed my mind, certainly, and I know you've changed the minds of many young libertarians about this crucially important topic. And I thank you for being on our show today, Stephan. We look forward to releasing your book very soon and to all your great work in the future.
Thanks, Jeff.
That was Stephan Kinsella. A real intellectual innovator. I've enjoyed hosting the show today. Of course, I'm just thrilled to have had these three mega high-powered intellectuals here to help me and help me see the world more clearly and help you see the world more clearly. I have a good colleague.